Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions expressed on Wolf Dog Radio by our guests and call-in listeners are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of the production team of the hosts of Wolf Dog Radio. We are open to your ideas for future radio programs. Please feel free to email us with questions or comments at questions@wolfdogradio.com.
Greetings and salutations. I'm Krista Ward, and welcome to Wolf Dog Radio. On this episode of Wolf Dog Radio, we have the pleasure of having Katie Beaver with us to discuss the theory and concepts involved with training. Katie has found that people who seek training for their animals do not generally have this knowledge and teaching of training their animals. While in the early stages of training brings a more complete scientific picture forward so that owners understand the reasoning behind what they are being taught. Tonight's interview with Katie is pre-recorded. We at Wolf Dog Radio feel the information Katie brought to us is so important and pertinent to the overall well-being of wolf dogs that we have divided the interview into two segments. The first segment will be aired tonight, with the second segment being aired in 2 weeks. Katie will join us at the end of the second segment on March 14th to answer your questions. While you are listening to tonight's interview, please note any questions you might have for Katie and send them to guest@wolfdogradio.com. We will be right back after a few words from Fromm.
Fromm Family Foods is an artisan pet food company. We make gourmet foods for dogs and cats. Our pet foods are naturally formulated. That means we use real meat, fish, fruits, and vegetables that are literally delivered to our doorstep every morning.
The ingredients going in are real meats and fresh vegetables, the same things you'd make a dinner for yourself with, essentially.
Any metropolitan city would have fresh produce brought in from all over the country. In this case, instead of delivering to the grocery store, they delivered to our pet food plant. It could be semi-loads at a time, but nevertheless, it's the same product that people would serve on their plates for their children at home.
Each Fromm recipe, whether it's from our classic, our gold, or our four-star line, starts with real meat or fish as the first ingredient. We then add in a blend of prebiotics and probiotics to aid digestion, and we top it off with real Wisconsin cheese and whole eggs from local farmers.
Day-to-day operations here, we blend and cook what we're going to finish that day. We start cooking the meats, we cook the vegetables, so everything that we've mixed and prepared for that day turns into a kibble, and that's when we know we're finished for the day. We don't have a lot of automation in our extrusion process here. We do it exactly the way we've always done it, very, very hands-on, so our operators understand what they're making.
We're there at the start of each batch. We're down there testing the product with our hands. We're even tasting it at times to make sure that it is up to our quality standards. There's certain parameters that you just can't program into a machine, where we still take a very hands-on approach to making pet food. It's one thing to have these elaborate entrees that have real meat and fish, fresh fruits and vegetables, but at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter unless your food's safe. And at Fromm, we take that extremely seriously. Each batch is sent off to an accredited lab, and we have our own on-site lab. And until both those labs clear our food, we will not ship a single kibble. Fromm Classic pays homage to our original Fromm Family recipe, which we came out with in 1949. It's chicken, brown rice, whole eggs, and Wisconsin cheese. Fromm Classic is the ultimate comfort food.
Our step up from the classic line is our gold line. They're based on life stage, so you can feed your puppy gold for your puppy, adult gold for your adult dog, as well as senior gold. Also on that line, we have a weight management formula, as well as large breed and small breed formulas.
The inspiration for the four-star line is actually pretty simple. It's how we feed our own family. We call it a center of the plate mentality, where you have a high quality protein like beef or lamb or duck, and then you surround that with sides like sweet potatoes, brown rice, or even cheese. It's variety driven, so your dog can have beef ricotta veg for breakfast, duck and sweet potato for lunch, and surf and turf for dinner.
I mean, there's really no better way to take care of your pet than feeding them well.
The main thing that sets our food apart is the time that we take in doing it.
We know that people, they always gather around the table, and that's where they share and break bread, and then pets, that's a very special time as a cat or dog when their owner is feeding them. So to have that type of variety is really important, and at the same time deliver unsurpassed nutrition.
This is Ian Dunbar, and you are listening to Wolf Dog Radio.
Katie has been working at All American Dog Training, Grooming, and More in Burleson, Texas for just over 2 years. There, she completed her dog training apprenticeship and has since been teaching group and private training classes. Katie is All American Dog Training, Grooming, and More's first in-house trained dog trainer. She is currently working towards accumulating enough hours to qualify for taking the Certification Council for Professional Dog Trainers. Knowledge Assess Test, which is a standardized test that proves those who pass have a strong enough foundation of knowledge and skills in science-based dog training. A minimum of 300 hours accrued over a 3-year span is required to qualify to take the CCPDT-KA test. Once passed, the trainer is required to maintain their knowledge and skills in various ways, such as attending seminars, working with other CCPDT trainers, and other things. All trainers must retake the test every 3 years to maintain their certification through CCPDT. Katie found her passion for training through taking training classes with her Temascan dog, Talia. Katie has successfully taken Talia as well as her two wolf dogs, Anubis and Reckless, through training classes at her work. At American Dog Training, Grooming, and More, Katie and other trainers base their training methods on science-based studies of canine ethology and behavior modification, using positive reinforcement methods to improve the quality of dogs' lives one family at a time. This means that outdated aversive punishment-based techniques are not used at American Dog Training and Grooming Management. Instead, positive reinforcement training methods are used to boost dogs' confidence and improve the bond of trust and love that is shared between dogs and their families. Welcome to the show, Katie.
And now our interview with Katie Bieber.
Hi, Katie. Thank you for being on the show, and we're very excited to have you tonight. How are you?
I'm good. Hi, Krista. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm excited about this training information and the episode tonight. I do have a few questions for you. And
okay.
I'm going to start with the first one, which is pretty basic, and it's, why is training our wolf dogs so important?
Well, natural behaviors governed by strong instincts are part of the package of owning a wolf dog, and those behaviors can sometimes be frustrating, exhausting, and confusing to us humans. As wolf dog owners, we do our best to help our animals live happy and fulfilled lives in our care, but a lot of wolf dog owners are presented daily with challenges that they may not realize can be remedied or improved upon with training. There are countless posts in every wolf dog group of owners who are asking questions about their animal's behavior. Why does my wolf dog do this? Why don't they do that? Well, it's pretty obvious there's a massive market out there for training dogs, but I think that a lot of wolf dog owners need to realize that these dog training methods work with wolf dogs too, and that taking even a basic obedience class with their animal could greatly improve the quality of the relationship that they share with their animal. There's a lot of myths out there regarding training wolves and wolf dogs. A lot of them are based on the outdated and disproven alpha theory. So it can be hard for a novice owner to tell the difference between truth and myth. And some of these training myths, especially those based on the disproven theory that we should be the, quote, pack leader, are very risky physically for the owner and the animal, and they can severely damage the emotional well-being of the animal, as well as the relationship between a wolf dog and its owner. So I think it's important to know how to locate a responsible trainer who is going to base their training program on current science, not myth. And I think the best way for us to be able to do that is to understand the basics of how these training methods work. By understanding why certain methods work better than others, or why certain approaches can harm versus help our animals' confidence and trust in humans, we can then find a trainer whose program excludes the techniques which have proven to be harmful to the animal, and only choose trainers who have a program that revolves around protecting our wolf dog's safety and their emotional well-being, and who can help us strengthen the incredible bond that we do share with these animals. By learning about these kinds of training methods and putting them into practice with our animals, we can learn how to improve the way that we communicate with our wolf dog partners, and that will lead to a better quality of life for the animals and for us as the owners.
I absolutely agree, and I think that it's very important that a lot of the community understands that it's a mutual respect between the animal and the owner. It's not an alpha thing, as you stated before, and that was very well stated, absolutely. Why do you think that these methods work with all contents?
Well, the really cool thing about these training methods is it actually doesn't matter what content your animal is, because these methods apply to all vertebrate animals. Zookeepers use these methods with training wolves, hyenas, felids, so big cats, small cats, cetaceans like whales and dolphins, apes, reptiles. I mean, you can even use this with fish. As long as the animal has the capability to learn and is properly motivated, they can be trained, and these methods will work. These methods work that I'll talk about later by teaching the animal to make choices based on how successful or not their past decisions were. So canids, for example, choose to repeat behaviors that have been rewarded in the past, and they will cease to repeat behaviors that no longer reward them. It makes sense if you think about the life of a wolf. Everything they do has to be efficient, so that they can preserve energy for hunting, patrolling their territory, and raising offspring. So it becomes a waste of energy to repeat behaviors that are not rewarding. So these instincts have carried over to our wolf dogs and even to dogs, which means that it's our job to show them that the behaviors we desire are more rewarding than the behaviors we do not want them to perform. And that can be something like jumping up on people or barking or howling, although it's kind of hard to get a wolf or a wolf dog not to howl. But by teaching them this, we are giving them the power to control their life. They can choose to cooperate with us because they know it rewards them. We don't have to force our wolf dogs to cooperate, and we don't have to use methods that rely on inflicting pain, fear, or distress.
Earlier, you mentioned that it's important to understand the instincts that cause wolf and wolf dog behavior. Would you try to explain those behaviors for us?
Sure. So first of all, we do need to understand what a behavior consists of, because there's actually three parts that consist of an entire behavior. And once we understand that, then we can apply that to the instincts that our animals do have. So the three parts of a behavior consist of the antecedent, the behavior itself, and then the consequence that happens after the behavior is completed. So the antecedent is a stimulus that cues the animal to perform a learned behavior. When the animal perceives an antecedent stimulus, they behave in a way that will maximize the reinforcing consequences. So in other words, the rewarding consequences, and minimizes the aversive or punishing consequences. So they're going to act in a way that maximizes reward and minimizes punishment or aversive outcomes. So once they perceive this stimulus, they're going to perform that behavior, and then there's going to be a consequence that happens after the behavior. So the consequence that happens after the behavior when we are training our wolf dogs will fall into four quadrants of operant conditioning, one of the four quadrants, which I can explain in a little bit, to either reinforce and reward the performed behavior or to punish the performed behavior. So an example of a complete sequence of a behavior would be I would cue my wolf dog using a hand signal to sit. My wolf dog would see that antecedent, the cue to sit, and they would perform the sit based on the experiences he has learned from in the past. He knows he's been rewarded for sitting on cue, and he knows that he will not be rewarded if he chooses not to sit on cue. So to him, the reward outweighs the perceived negative consequence of no reward, so he will choose to sit. Now, the consequence after he chooses to sit will be me choosing to reward my wolf dog for sitting because I want him to continue to sit on cue. I want that behavior to be repeated. So again, that example of consequence where I reward him for behaving on cue would fall into the quadrant of positive reinforcement. So that way, when we know a wolf dog is going to act out of their desire to maximize reward and minimize punishment, we can understand, okay, my wolf dog is hungry, so he's going to figure out, how can I get food? What behaviors have I learned that have earned me food in the past? Maybe my human likes it when I sit, and they don't like it when I jump. So by teaching our wolf dogs basic rules, we can allow them to make the choice to perform behaviors based on how successful their actions have been in the past. So if my wolf dog is hungry and it's dinner time and he runs up and he jumps on me because he's excited for dinner, I'm not going to feed him until he politely sits. So he's going to learn jumping doesn't work. There's a negative consequence to jumping. He doesn't get his food. So as soon as he sits, which I will cue him to do, so he'll see the antecedent, he'll perform the sit, the consequence will be he gets his dinner. So he will learn through repetition that choosing to do the behavior that has been rewarded is going to get him his dinner. If that makes sense?
Absolutely. And I think that you're explaining it really well for the listeners, for sure.
Okay.
And I think that you're breaking it down really well, Katie.
Awesome. So I think the next thing that I'd like to talk about would actually be what the four quadrants of operant conditioning are, since I did mention those earlier, and it's really important for us as owners and as trainers to understand. So the four quadrants of operant conditioning are a bit confusing to people sometimes, and I want to establish some vocabulary definitions before I jump into the names themselves. So we're going to hear words like reinforcement, punishment, positive, and negative. Now, a lot of people have, over the years, associated certain definitions to those words, but I want to make sure for the purpose of training, we're very clear as to exactly what those words mean. So when we hear reinforcement, that means we are increasing desirable behaviors. You want these behaviors to be repeated again in the future. When we hear punishment, we are decreasing undesirable behaviors. You do not want these behaviors to be repeated in the future. When you hear positive, I want you to think of it not as good or happy. I want you to think of it as a math problem. So positive is a plus sign. This means we are adding a consequence after a behavior is performed. When you hear negative, again, think of it as a math problem. Negative means minus sign. We are removing a consequence after a behavior is performed. And a consequence itself is going to be either rewarding or punishing. There's no inherent good or bad associated with the word consequence, so it can go either way, and it's up to us to choose. So, the four quadrants of operant conditioning. The first one is positive reinforcement. Then there's negative reinforcement. There's positive punishment, and there's negative punishment. So let's talk about what all of that means. Positive reinforcement, again, plus sign, positive reinforcement, we are rewarding desirable behaviors. So adding a reinforcing stimulus after a desirable behavior is performed, that increases the likelihood the behavior will be repeated in the future. An example of that would be rewarding your wolf dog with a treat after they sit, so they're likely to do it again in the future when you ask them to sit. Negative reinforcement is when you remove a stimulus, which is usually an aversive stimulus to some degree, once a desirable behavior is performed. Removal of the stimulus rewards the behavior and increases the likelihood it will be repeated in the future. So that sounds a little confusing. I've come up with two examples for us. The first example would be applying tension to the leash so that your wolf dog feels pressure on their collar or harness, whatever you guys use. And we are going to wait for the wolf dog to release the tension by stepping towards us. The release of pressure on the wolf dog's collar or harness rewards the wolf dog and teaches them to voluntarily release tension on the leash by moving closer to the handler. My other example is horse training. Horse training is almost entirely comprised of negative reinforcement. So if you think about horse training, we use a lot of touch-based signals to cue our horses to perform various movements. So the pressure of the cue is removed once the behavior is performed. The release of that pressure is the reward that increases the repetition of the desired behavior in the future. So, for example, if I wanted my horse to step sideways, I would go up and I would start poking her in the side, and I would continue to do that until she shifted sideways. As soon as she shifted sideways, I would stop poking her. By repeating this enough times, she'll start to understand, oh, if my mom touches my side, I need to step sideways and she'll stop. So that would be an example of negative reinforcement. Again, positive and negative, we don't want to think of those as good or bad. It's a plus sign and a minus sign. So the next quadrant is positive punishment. This is where we add an aversive consequence after an undesired behavior is performed, to decrease the likelihood that behavior will be performed again in the future. Some examples of these would be yelling at your wolf dog if they jump on people, or squirting them with a water bottle if they bark, spanking them if they nip. You are adding a negative consequence, a punishment, after they perform a behavior we don't like. We have to be very careful with positive punishment, because a lot of that can easily get carried away. There are quite a few trainers out there who go right to the most aversive, the most painful or upsetting consequence that they can think of to try to scare the animal into never repeating that behavior in the future. This is where we see things like shock collars, prong collars, citronella spray collars, stuff like that. I personally do not recommend using those techniques with wolf dogs, and we can talk about that a little bit later, because my last quadrant that I'd like to talk about is negative punishment. This is when we are removing a rewarding consequence once an undesired behavior is performed to decrease the likelihood that the behavior will be performed again in the future. So a good example of negative punishment would be losing privileges. Let's say you are walking your wolf dog and you see a friend approaching you down the sidewalk, and your wolf dog just gets super excited. They really want to greet their friend that they know, and they start to pull you to go greet that person. Well, if you don't want your wolf dog to pull, then we're going to prevent them from getting to that person. They don't get to greet their friend if they're pulling. They lost that privilege. So we are removing that rewarding consequence of greeting their friend because they performed an undesired behavior, pulling. So if we repeat that enough times, our wolf dog is going to learn, every time I pull, I don't get to go anywhere. I don't get to greet anyone. I don't get to smell the bush that I want to pee on or go meet that other dog that I was excited about. Don't get to do any of that. We only get to go somewhere and do things when I walk politely. So that's one way that we teach leash manners. That way we can impose a consequence without punishing our wolf dog in a harmful, painful, distressing way. We can remove the desired object or person or place until they behave. It'd be kind of like taking a kid to a candy store and saying, okay, you can get candy, but you can't run around and be crazy about it. You have to be polite. And if your kid loses their mind and runs around and grabs all the candy off the shelves and fights over it with their friend or their sibling, well, no candy, sorry, let's go home. If that makes sense at all.
Absolutely. And I love the way that you've explained each quadrant individually. And they're all a little bit different, but at the same time, you can see a connection between some of them. And that's very, very important for the listeners, I believe, is that each one you can see a little bit of difference, and it will, you know, vastly affect how your wolf dog responds to the training. So very good information there. And I've also heard of terms being used such as cues, markers, and rewards being used in training. How do you define and use those in your training?
Okay. Well, a cue is any perceivable physical gesture, sight, such as light for a deaf dog, or sound that signals the animal to perform a learned behavior. So that could be a hand signal telling my wolf dog I want them to lay down. It could be a verbal signal saying, hey, come, Fluffy, come, or, you know, my wolf dog Anubis, come. It could be, again, if you have a deaf dog, some trainers use flashing lights to cue them that to perform a behavior. Some trainers use whistles. If you've ever gone to SeaWorld, you've seen the trainers use different blasts on their whistle to cue the whales to perform different behaviors, as well as hand signals. So that would be a cue. A marker would be a consistent sound or word that signals the exact moment the animal has successfully performed the desired behavior. So a lot of trainers like to use a marker such as a clicker, but we see also training whistles. You can make up your own whistle or a verbal cue such as, or I'm sorry, not a cue, a verbal marker such as yes, like yes, you did that right, yes, good sit, or something like that. And then a reward is necessary when you're using a marker. So when our wolf dogs are in training with us, we have to remember that the marker itself is not the reward. It's just a sound or a word that told them, hey, what you did right there, that was a good job. But that's not very rewarding. It's just a sound or it's just a word. So we need to follow that with an actual reward. A lot of trainers like to use treats, because food is generally pretty motivating for most canids. There are the rare dogs and wolf dogs out there who are not treat motivated, so we would choose to use a different motivator, such as praise or a toy. If you've ever seen a border collie, for example, they sometimes get really excited over toys. So we would use that to reward them instead of a treat. Or if your wolf dog is very praise motivated, just telling them, good job, good boy, you know, that can be rewarding to them. It just depends on the individual animal. But it's very important to always follow your marker with a reward so that you are actually rewarding their behavior. Again, the marker itself is just a sound or a word that says what you did right there was good, and then the reward is like their paycheck. They want to be motivated to work for us, just the same way that people go to work and we earn a paycheck and that motivates us to keep going back to work. Our wolf dogs need to feel like they get a paycheck too. Nobody likes to work for free. So instead of expecting them to work for free or expecting them to work out of motivation like fear or avoiding pain, we want to motivate our wolf dogs to work out of enjoyment. We want them to realize that working with us is fun and that they get something that they enjoy out of it, aside from just spending time with us. So we want to make sure that every time we use our marker, we reward that with a treat, a toy, or praise to make sure that the marker does not lose meaning. If we start to use the marker but we don't reward after it, it will start to lose value to the animal. So eventually they may say, well, I know you click and treat usually, but a couple times now you clicked but you didn't treat. So am I really doing it right? Or maybe you clicked and treated a couple times and then you clicked only and you didn't treat, and they start to lose motivation to work for you because you're withholding their paycheck and they're starting to work for free, and some animals don't like to do that. So it's really important to find what motivates your animal and use that to your advantage. Sometimes your reward can vary depending on your situation. You know, not everybody carries around a bag of treats with them everywhere they go. So we can vary our reward based on the situation. One thing I do want to mention for our listeners, if you do choose to use a marker when training your wolf dog, I want you guys to make sure that you always use your reward after you sound your marker, even if it was an accident. So an example that I always see when I'm teaching loose leash walking with my classes, sometimes the dog will pull on the leash and the handler will accidentally click their clicker. Well, we still have to give our dog a treat or praise them or let them play with their toy for a second, because our animal doesn't understand that it was an accident. So we don't want that marker to lose value. We don't want it to lose meaning. So even if we have an accidental click, or if you're using the word yes, try to follow that with a reward every time. And knowing that we have to reward even our accidents usually tends to increase the discipline of the handler in using their marker appropriately. So that way, our animals are only being marked and rewarded for the correct behavior.
What other training issues would you like to make our listeners aware of, Katie?
That's a big question. Well, one thing that I see a lot of, especially in a lot of the myths out there about training wolves and wolf dogs, is things like misplaced punishment is what I call it, where let's say you're potty training your wolf dog while you're raising them in the house when they're little. There's an old myth out there that rubbing their nose in their mess will teach them that they did wrong and that they shouldn't potty in the house. But I want our listeners to understand that canids actually have about a 3 to 5 second window where they can associate a consequence, be it rewarding or punishing, with the action they performed. Once that window of time has passed, they're not able to associate a consequence with their action. So it's not a good idea to attempt to punish or reward our wolf dog after 3 to 5 seconds has passed. So again, the potty accident example. Let's say you have your puppy inside and you haven't been paying attention for a couple minutes, or let's say you left them in a pen, penned up area of the house, and you were away from the house for a little while. You come back, there's a poop on the floor. Well, according to that old myth, you're supposed to rub their nose in that poop to show them that they did wrong. However, more than 3 to 5 seconds has passed, so our wolf dogs are not going to understand why we're doing this awful behavior to them. They're not going to understand why they're being punished. To them, that just makes us seem unpredictable because they can't associate the punishment with the potty accident. So this type of punishment where we punish them way after something undesirable has happened can definitely weaken the bond of trust that they have in us. And it can make us seem, again, unpredictable. They don't understand why they're being punished. So they're not going to be as open to spending time with us if, in their eyes, we randomly punish them for no reason. So I really want people to make sure, follow that 3-5 second window where your animal can still associate behaviors with a reward or a punishment. I know it's frustrating, especially when we've got the younger guys who are just learning the rules of living with us, be it inside the house or outside in a containment. We just need to have a lot of patience, and we need to realize that we are diligent about paying attention. It can be really easy, especially with puppies, to turn our back and do the dishes or grab the laundry, cook dinner, and all of a sudden, puppy had a potty accident. Well, we have to think of it as that wasn't the puppy's fault, that was our fault. And we can't punish them. Too much time has passed, and they just won't understand why they're being punished. I also think that it's very, very important for people to understand the signs of stress that canids, such as wolves and dogs, will display, especially in training where we are either interacting with our animals at home or maybe there's people who will take their animals out in public. Knowing when your animal is stressed is going to be very important in how you approach training them and how you set up their environment. So I want to go over some of the progression of warning signs and appeasement gestures that our animals will show us. So I'm going to start at the most mild form of appeasement gestures and calming signals that they will try to show us. And I'm going to gradually go up the scale that has been established to where they are actually showing us, hey, buddy, I mean business. You better stop. So, again, starting at the most mild, some appeasement and calming gestures that indicate mild to moderate stress would be yawning, even when they're not tired, excessive blinking, avoiding eye contact with us or averting their gaze. You may see them flicking their tongue out and licking their nose. Once their stress becomes more pronounced, you may see them turning their head away or turning their whole body away. They'll start heavily panting and excessively drooling. They may turn and curve their body away in a C shape away from us. They may sit with a raised paw and kind of paw at us in a supplication type gesture towards us if we're stressing them out or if there's something else stressing them out. They may try to walk away and just increase the distance between them and the stressor to try to disengage. They may creep and crouch with their head lowered and their tail tucked. Their ears may be folded back. They may stand crouched with their back hunched up, their tail tucked firmly between their legs, their head lowered down, maybe even turned away so that they're not looking at us. Some wolf dogs, especially the more submissive puppies, will even lie down to show their belly. They may submissively urinate or defecate. Some will put a leg up while they're upside down to just show, hey, I'm upset. I'm not a threat. Just leave me alone. I don't want any part of this. Once the stress of the animal has escalated so much that they feel like these signals are not working, that the stressor is just still upsetting them, they may feel like they have to defend themselves. So when they feel like there's no choice between fighting for their life or trying to say, whoa, buddy, back up. If whoa, buddy, back up isn't working, they may start to stiffen and freeze, and they may give us a hard eye. I've tried to read different articles online to try to explain it better, because it's really something that you know when you see it. But from my experience in working with animals, canids, both at the kennel and outside of the kennel where I work, when you see a dog or a wolf dog giving you the hard eye, their whole face just tightens, their brow will furrow a bit, their pupils may dilate or constrict, and it's a very unmistakable look. They mean business, and you will know it when you see it. It's almost like they're glaring at you. It can be pretty intimidating. If they are giving you the hard eye, that's a good indication that you need to stop whatever is upsetting them and give them space, because they mean business. They may growl, pucker their lips, show teeth, and snarl at us. Once they have exhausted these warning signs and they feel like the only thing left to do is fight, usually animals will give a snap, a warning snap, a click of the teeth, hey, I mean business, stop. That's them warning us. And I'm sure most wolf dog owners will agree that these guys have pretty good control of their mouths. They know what they're doing with their teeth. So if they snap at you, really pay attention and figure out, how did I mess up? What am I doing wrong? How am I upsetting them? And try to fix it, because they're not happy. If a warning bite is not working for them, then they will feel like their last ditch effort is to go for a full-on bite. There are different degrees of dog bites, and Dr. Sophia Yin actually has an excellent infographic that will illustrate and define the varying degrees of dog bites from the warning snap all the way up to a fatal dog bite where there is death of the victim. So I definitely recommend that listeners look up Dr. Sophia Yin, Y-I-N is how you spell her last name, and look up Dr. Sophia Yin's degrees of dog bites. The infographic is great. I really advocate knowing how to tell the difference between a warning snap and the more serious dog bites. Especially with our reactive guys, we want to make sure that we understand we need to respect these stress signals and these warning signals. Wolf dogs, from my experience, I have found them to be excellent communicators. They will go through the whole list of, hey, buddy, I'm a little stressed, to back up, I mean business. The whole range. And I feel like if we are not able to spot these stress signs and these warning signals, we as handlers are going to fail our wolf dog at some point. If we can't spot stress, there is going to be a time where your animal is upset and you're not going to see it. And you may accidentally put them up in a situation where they feel like they do need to defend themselves, to make themselves clear. So I really encourage listeners to check out the infographic. There's also hundreds of articles online that talk about the different stress signals that you can see from dogs. There's excellent picture examples. There's stories. Really do your homework. Especially with these guys, we want to make sure that we keep them in a safe situation. We want to make them feel safe and secure. We want them to trust that we can see these stress signals and that we can help them get back to their safe space where they feel comfortable. So please be aware, especially if you have children or if you ever take your animal out in public, please know the signs of stress. I do have to say, please do not ever leave children unattended with any dog or wolf dog, no matter what age the child or animal is. Only an adult should be the one in charge of determining whether an animal is too stressed to continue interacting with the general public or with a child. So that way we can keep our animals in the safest situations possible for us and for them.
Absolutely. I agree completely. As a mother of two children and a mother of wolf dogs, I can completely relate to that last statement 100%. Very good information that everyone should definitely pay attention to their wolf dog, and especially in a stressful environment. And these guys get stressed out so easily. So very important to be completely in tune with your woofer when you're out in public or just really in general. I think that's great information.
Katie, I want to thank you for taking the time to put all of this information together so that we all have a better understanding of what goes into training any canine or animal. Hearing the reasoning and the concepts of why different methods and techniques are used helps the dedication and hard work trainers. Hearing the reasoning and concepts of why different methods and techniques are used helps show the dedication and hard work trainers must have in order to assist the animals in having a more compassionate owner on the end of a leash or in giving commands. Listeners, please pay a visit to our website at wolfdogradio.com for the links we talked about in tonight's interview. Remember to tune in to our next broadcast as Katie returns and talks about puppy development and continues with techniques to enhance your wolf dog's training. We will be right back after this very important message from Peter Coyote about Project Coyote.
Each year, millions of Americans make their way to wilderness areas and national parks to get a glimpse of the magic and beauty of nature and wildlife. Visitors to Yellowstone consistently rank bears, wolves, coyotes, and foxes at the top of their list to see, with many waiting their entire lives to observe these predators in the wild. We have a long tradition of wildlife appreciation and conservation in this country, and yet, few people know that millions of wild animals are killed each year by a single, little-known government agency, ironically named Wildlife Services. Hundreds of thousands more die because of trophy hunting and recreational fur trapping, and unlimited numbers more are allowed to be killed during barbaric wildlife killing contests, where children are invited to participate, and prizes are awarded to those who kill the most and the largest. The same animals that people spend millions to see in places like Yellowstone are indiscriminately killed in such brutal events. Such a cruel slaughter of animals is a betrayal of the public trust and all conservation instincts. Hello, I'm Peter Coyote. For many years, Project Coyote has been taking the lead in educating communities about coexistence, pressing for legislative and policy reform to stop this assault on wildlife, and keeping a sharp eye on Wildlife Services. Wildlife Services targets apex predators, wolves, coyotes, cougars, bobcats, for extermination. Even though more successful non-lethal programs like the Marin Livestock and Wildlife Protection Program exist. That program is more effective, cheaper, and safer. Targeting apex predators can have disastrous results on the environment. They're like the keystone in an arch that keep the integrity of the whole environment in place. Once it's removed, the system that supports all life collapses. Project Coyote's coalition of wildlife scientists, educators, predator-friendly ranchers, and community leaders are dedicated to ending these practices and ensuring that our wildlife and our ecosystems thrive by teaching and promoting compassionate conservation and coexistence across North America.
We chose the coyote as our flagship animal because they are the most persecuted, misunderstood, maligned native carnivore in North America. And we estimate that at least 500,000 are killed every year through killing contests, hunting, trapping. This averages about one per minute. So we truly believe that if we can ultimately shift the way we view and treat coyotes, we can shift the way we view and treat all predators.
When I joined Project Coyote's advisory board, I was really impressed by the organization's dedication to bridge building, to shifting attitudes by education and building alternatives and policy programs based on sound science. Project Coyote's advisory board includes some of the most renowned ecological and social scientists in the world. Our six core programs focus on changing legislation and policies and reducing human-animal conflicts by promoting education, science, and advocacy. All financial donations go directly to supporting these programs, so you can be sure that your contributions are supporting and protecting wildlife. We're at a critical point in our planet's evolution in regards to species conservation, mass extinctions, and protecting diversity. The choices that we make today will precisely determine the kind of a planet in which our children and grandchildren live. Help us protect the future by supporting Project Coyote, by demanding that legislators incorporate sound science into their legislation and their policies, that they promote ethical considerations, and that we work together to preserve the diversity and health of our wildlife and our ecosystems. Please join Project Coyote today. Help us ensure the future.
Join us!
Of Wolfdogdom, and you're listening to Wolfdog Radio.
And now it's time for Wolfdog Radio News.
Good evening. This is Greg Argent with tonight's edition of In the News. Our first news article is from the PLOS News Research Agency with Tessa Gregory reporting dated February 22nd of this year. Hunting in the Himalayas, a predation analysis of snow leopards and Himalayan wolves. Killing livestock creates conflict between top predators and communities that graze animals. This presents a major challenge for conserving snow leopards, which are endangered, and Himalayan wolves, which are rare. These wolves prefer the open grasslands and alpine meadows that are also frequented by pastoral herders, and snow leopards prefer the steep terrain associated with mountainous pastures. To assess the prey preferences of associated carnivores, Mr. Madhu Chetri from the Inland Norway University of Applied Science in Norway and his colleagues analyzed DNA and hair in 182 snow leopard droppings and 57 wolf droppings collected in the central Himalayas in Nepal. Mr. Chetri answered some questions about his recently published PLOS One study. What sparked your interest in science? His response, I grew up in the countryside and I spent most of my childhood days in the woods. Since then, I have been attracted to nature and fascinated by wild animals. This magnetic pull led me to study science. When asked what drew you to studying the diets of snow leopards and Himalayan wolves, his response, more than a decade of work experience in the Himalayas revealed that endangered snow leopards and rare wolves, the two top predators, are always considered to be a threat by the pastoral communities and blamed for livestock losses. Since diet studies can explain the real situation, I became more interested. Studying their diets also helped understand food choice and preferences as well as the abundance and status of their prey, which are both essential for formulating long-term conservation strategies. When asked that he found that livestock compromised about a quarter of the Himalayan snow leopard and wolf's diet, what was this a smaller or larger portion of their diet than was expected? His response, around a quarter of the snow leopard and wolf diet is much less than expected. The complaints from pastoral communities regarding livestock losses are common, suggesting that animals would comprise a larger portion of these predators' diets. Also, site-specific losses are highly variable. When he was asked what the complications were in his findings having more conservation of snow leopards and wolves, his response, the present findings are part of a larger ongoing research on snow leopard ecology in the central Himalayas. The main aim is to investigate the abundance, food, choice, and preferences, and evaluate the level of conflicts. When these are all integrated, the final outcome will provide meaningful conservation implications for the long-term survival of the snow leopard, wolves, and their prey species within the Himalayas. Are there limitations to your study? His response, the main limitations of our study is the location of grid cells. A random or systematic selection of sampling grid cells was not feasible due to geographical, cultural, and logistical constraints. When asked what the next steps of his research might be, his response was that although livestock contains a substantial proportion of the predators' diets, little is known about the actual predation impact on the pastoral communities. Hence, the forthcoming work focuses on estimating livestock mortality rates and identifying factors associated with livestock loss. It will also evaluate snow leopard abundance and distribution in the central Himalayas. Our last piece for the night is entitled Wolf Numbers Are Up, Genetic Diversity is Still Problematic. This is from the Independent with Trudy Balcom reporting on February 24th. This is regarding Mexican gray wolves. The annual census of the Mexican gray wolf population is complete, and it shows an uptick in the number of wild wolves across eastern Arizona and western New Mexico. Last year's count showed a minimum of 97 wild wolves across the region. This year, 113 wolves were counted between November and February, according to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service press release issued on February 17th. This is the largest number of wolves documented in the count since wolf reintroduction first began in 1998. The count is conducted by field biologists on the ground using radio and GPS collar data and with aerial surveys conducted by helicopter and fixed-wing aircraft. The number issued at the completion of the count is called a minimum. A minimum count is the number of wolves we visibly see. We know there are more wolves out there, but we don't have a maximum number, explained John Bradley, Public Information Officer for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The count documented a total of 21 wolf packs with at least 50 wolves in New Mexico and 63 in Arizona. A total of 50 surviving wild-born wolf pups born in 2016 were part of that population's total count. A net growth in the population of at least 16 wolves is in line with goals for the recovery of the Mexican gray wolf in the wild. Our goal is to achieve an average animal growth rate of 10% in the Mexican wolf population, says Dr. Benjamin Tuggle, Southwest Regional Director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, in a press release. Population numbers for the wolves have fluctuated since 1998. A milestone of 100 wolves was first reached in 2010, when 110 wolves were counted. In 2015, the number dropped back to 97. Even though the count is completed in February, the number of wolves counted is attributed to the previous year, so the number for the count completed earlier this month will be designated as the 2016 count. 11 wolf deaths from 2016 are under investigation by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service Law Enforcement Agency, according to the press release. Although the Mexican wolf population numbers are up, wolf managers continue to struggle with a lack of genetic diversity among the wild wolves. Many of the wolves currently in the wild are descendants of the Blue Stem Pack, an Arizona pack that featured a productive alpha female. Although four different mating pairs cycled through the Bluestone Pack in the earlier years, nearly every wild Mexican wolf in both states carries the genetics of this pack, and wolf managers want to change this. On average, individuals within the population are as related as full siblings. According to the initial release and translocation report proposal for 2017, a planning document which was issued in early February, two wolf pairs with pups may be released into the Gila Wilderness and also Leopold Wilderness in New Mexico in early summer to foster better genetic diversity. The release of these wolves is being carefully planned to minimize potential livestock conflicts, according to the Fish and Wildlife Service document. In Arizona, more genetically diverse wolf pups born to mothers in captivity will be placed into the dens of wild wolf mothers with pups of the same age later this spring. The technique known as cross-fostering is another method for increasing genetic diversity in the wild pack. New wolf releases have been banned by Arizona Game and Fish Department for some time. A three-strike rule was initiated against wolves that preyed on livestock from 2005 to 2007. The offending wolves, along with their offspring, were removed from the wild if they attacked livestock three times. There are relatively genetically diverse populations in 2005. Well, there were. Then there was intense removal. There are no new releases. That's how it got to be how it is now, with the lack of diverse population, Mr. Fredrickson explained. All of the most genetically important packs were removed, he said. Fredrickson called the removals draconian. He believes that if the wolves had been left undisturbed, the wild population would have grown and the genetics improved. The upshot, in my opinion, is the Mexican wolves have not been allowed to succeed. The main constraint has been humans, not genetics, he said. That's tonight's edition of In the News for Wolf Dog Radio. Have a good evening and enjoy the rest of the show.
Diversify.
Hi, listeners. This is Robbie Ames. Today, I'm here to tell you about an exciting new sponsor of the Ask Cat Show, JK Diversified Construction and Development, serving the Tampa Bay area. The inspiring owners of this company are Tom Shumlick and Kit Prang. Between Tom, general contractor, architect, interior designer, and Kip, building perfectionist extraordinaire, you can be assured of a design-build experience that will fulfill all your dreams of that perfect custom home or business. Just visit their website at jkdiversified.com. That's jkdiversified.com.
Wolf Dog Radio, four paws on the ground, eyes on the moon, and nothing but the truth.
And now it's time for one of my favorite segments, Ask Cat.
Wolf Dog Radio is proud to present an interactive portion where you can send your questions and have them personally answered by Cat Wolf Dancer. Just send your questions to askcat@wolfdogradio.com.
Greetings and salutations. This is Cat Wolf Dancer, and this is Ask Cat. Almost anything, and if I don't know it, I'll sure try to find it out. Here you go. This question is from Mike. Back to behaviors about playing. Can you please answer the following? How rough can you play with your wolf dog? I know that what they do as puppies, they do as adults, but my friends really like to tussle. I think it's cute now, but, well, Mike, the roughest I play with my kids is a tug-and-release game. You'll find a whole lot of different opinions on this, though. It's just what I feel comfortable with. I've always figured that being raised and played with gently increases the likelihood that they are going to grow up to treat humans gently. My reasons also include the fact that wolf dogs can get pretty big and are very athletic, and they are very enthusiastic greeters, usually. They don't generalize well. Now, what do I mean by that? It means that the play that you have taught him to engage in may not be the play that he engages with somebody else with. So what we want to do is to try to make sure that he grows up successful with people. Active tussling can just get way too out of control way too quickly, especially when other people who might not know your pup as well as you do, they might not know his triggers or his signals that he's ratcheting up the energy. You don't want them to get too hyped up because it's a whole lot harder to shut down the adrenaline once it's already hit the system than it is to calm the situation down before they get too hyper. Now, a tug toy also gives you the opportunity to teach leave it or out. And these are really important training lessons for good manners and as well as emergencies, as well as giving him an outlet for his puppy energy. You can even get tug to be a reward for other training times. Take a break during a training session and play a 15-minute tug game. And remember to allow him to win about half the time because, you know, everybody likes to win. Otherwise, I try to stick with puzzle games, search games, tickle games, games that engage his mind as well as his body. I hope that helps. Now, our second question is, my friend's wolf dog insists upon licking me on the mouth. He will seek out my face even when I cover it up to lick my lips. Is this normal? Yes, it is. Very normal. It's part of the feeding ritual between pups and adults in a wolf family unit. In wolf families, when the adult hunters come back to the den site, the pups mob them and lick their jowls and lips, soliciting the adults to empty their stomachs of the meat from the most recent kill. But this behavior isn't only a feed-me-see-more type of a thing. It's also a greeting and a sign of respect to a higher-ranking adult. They will continue this licking-up behavior all throughout their lives as a way to express happiness or to greet someone that they're fond of. Wolves and wolf dogs, as I've said before, are really enthusiastic in their emotions, or as a way to rally up the family before moving out. If you don't want her to jump up on you, come on down to her level. She's going to kiss you anyway, you lucky guy. And the last question's from Tad. Doghouses, well, wolf dog houses. I live up north, and it gets very cold. Do you have a two-room doghouse, or what kind of a doggy house would you suggest for warmth? Would an igloo suffice? Not a real igloo, you know, one of those plastic ones. Also, he eats blankets, so blankets are not a good idea. What would I line it with? Boy, Tad, these are great. That's a great question, series of great questions. There are so many different ways to build a warm doghouse. It depends on the situation and the imagination to design one. I'm not too sure that the igloo is really insulated enough for really cold nights. They only seem to have that one layer of plastic for the wall,
maybe two, but they don't really seem very warm. I've seen folks make some really cool doghouses out of bales of straw and a few pieces of plywood. These only last a couple years at the most, but they're nice and cozy, and you can scatter the bales open when they get too old. And they're fairly inexpensive. You can also build a secure, sturdy, relatively inexpensive wooden house with an insulating inner wall and wooden floors. If you're crafty, you can use pallets as the frames and sheet inside and out with exterior plywood. I usually build mine around the length of a sheet of plywood, about 8 feet long, so the back is well out of drafts, and mine have the entry at the short end. They will probably gnaw on the edges of the wood, so try to frame the edges with 4x4s. Remember, woofers really love to lounge up high, so they will want to get on top of the house. You might want to include a couple of steps so that they don't hurt themselves trying to get up there. And also make sure that you, whenever you build a doghouse, whatever structure you make, make sure that any housing structure or standing structure is about 6 feet back from the fence line, or else they can use that to launch over the fence. And as far as stuffing it goes, or lining it, I would stuff it with straw. Straw is very insulating because the tubes of the straw itself are hollow. And I just stuff it with like a bale or two inside so that it's a foot deep or something. They love to nest around and rustle around in it. I avoid pine and cedar shavings because sometimes that can get too fine and it can trigger some breathing issues. Now, these are just a few ideas. Where it's cold, remember, insulation is a good thing. We'd love to see what you come up with, so make sure to send us pictures to askcat@wolfdogradio.com. We've got some really good questions coming up next show, too, so please tune in next time. This is Ask Cat.
Now it's time for everyone's favorite Rage and Cajun, Jerry Mills.
Hi, I'm Jerry Mills, and this is the Wolf Tejas Den. Well, tonight we've talked a lot about training, and I have a few interesting things for you that might help you understand better how your dog perceives the world. What emotions do dogs actually experience? Well, since most of us routinely read emotions in our dogs, you know, the wagging tail, meaning happy, cringing, meaning afraid, and so forth, well, it may be difficult to believe that the existence of real emotions in dogs was, and in some places still is, a point of scientific controversy. In the distant past, it was presumed that dogs had a very rich mental life with feelings and much like those of humans. However, with the rise of science and things began to change, we learned enough about the principles of physics and mechanics that we could build complex machines and begin to notice that living things, both people and animals, were also based upon systems governed by mechanical rules and chemical processes. In the face of such discoveries, religion stepped in to suggest that there must be more to human beings than simply mechanical and chemical events. Church scholars insisted that people have souls, and the evidence they gave for this was the fact that humans have consciousness and feelings. While animals might have the same mechanical systems, but they did not have a divine spark, and therefore they did not have the ability to experience true feelings. Since most research at that time was church-sponsored, it is not surprising that prominent scholars, such as the French philosopher and scientist René Descartes, adopted this viewpoint. In a highly influential set of analysis, Descartes suggested that animals, like dogs, were simply some kind of machine, simply being a dog-shaped chassis filled with a biological equivalent of gears and pulleys. Although this machine doesn't have consciousness and emotions, they can still be programmed to do certain things. Well, in recent times, science has progressed a long way past Descartes, and we understand that dogs have all the same structures that produce emotions in humans. Dogs also have the same hormones and undergo the same chemical changes that humans do during emotional states. Dogs even have the hormone oxytocin, which in human beings is involved with the feeling of love and affection for others. With the same neurology and chemistry that people have, it seems reasonable to suggest that dogs also have emotions that are similar to ours. However, it is important to not go overboard and immediately assume that the emotional ranges of dogs and humans are the same. To understand what dogs feel, we must turn to research which was done to explore the emotions of humans. Not all people had the full range of possible emotions. In fact, at some points in your life, you did not have the full complement of emotions that you feel and express today. Research shows that infants and very young children have a more limited range of emotions, but over time, the child's emotions begin to differentiate and they become to be able to experience different and more complex emotional states. This data is important to our understanding of the emotional lives of dogs because researchers have come to believe that the mind of a dog is roughly equivalent to that of a human who is 2 to 2.5 years old. This conclusion holds for most mental abilities, including emotions. Thus, we can look to the human research to see what we might expect of our dogs. Like a young child, dogs will clearly have emotions, but many fewer kinds of emotions that we find in adults. The developmental sequence is the golden key to understanding the emotion of dogs. Dogs go through their developmental stages much more quickly than humans do and have all the emotional range that they will ever achieve by the time they are 4 to 6 months of age, depending on the rate or the maturing in their breed. However, we know that the assortment of emotions available to the dog will not exceed that which is available to a human who is 2 to 2.5 years old. This means that a dog will have all the basic emotions, joy, fear, anger, disgust, and even love. However, based on current research, it seems like that your dog will not have more complex emotions like guilt, pride, or shame. Well, now, many people might argue that we've seen evidence which indicates that their dog is capable of experiencing guilt. Well, the usual situation is where you come home and your dog starts slinking around and showing discomfort, and you know, then you find you go through there and see that little smelly brown package that he's left on your kitchen floor. Well, it's not natural to conclude that the dog is acting in a way that shows that it's feeling guilty about its transgression. However, this is not guilt, but simply the basic emotion of fear. The dog has learned that when you appear and his little brown package is laying there on the floor for you, well, bad things happen. You get mad at him, and what you see is his fear of punishment. He doesn't feel the guilt. So what does this mean for those of us who live with and interact with our dogs? Well, the good news is you can feel free to dress your dog in a silly costume for a party or Halloween or whatever, and he won't feel no shame, regardless of how stupid or ridiculous he might look. But he will also not feel pride at winning a prize at a dog show or an obedience competition. However, your dog can still feel love for you and contentment when you're around. And aren't those the emotions we truly value? Now, let's talk a little bit about what do dogs see. Well, human eyes have three cones that detect color and can identify red, blue, green, and yellow wavelengths created by light entering the eye. Dogs only have two cones. This means they can distinguish blue and yellow, but not red and green. The cones are responsible for color vision, so the fact that they are there means that dogs do see color. They just see it differently. Their vision is dichromatic, so they primarily see blues and yellows. Humans usually see trichromatically, with visible variations of red, blue, and yellow. Veterinarians used to believe that dogs saw only in black and white, but recent studies suggest that they actually do have some color vision, but it's not as bright as a human's. In other words, dogs see the colors of the world as basically yellow, blue, and gray. For dogs, their color vision is most similar to a human with red-green color blindness, although there are other differences. Dogs are less sensitive to variations in gray shades than humans are, as well as only about half as sensitive to changes in brightness. Dogs also tend to be a little nearsighted to varying degrees. Dr. Neitz confirmed that dogs actually do see color, but many fewer colors than normal humans do. Instead of seeing the rainbow as violet, blue, blue-green, green, yellow, orange, and red, dogs would see it as dark blue, gray, light yellow, a darker yellow, to all the way to a sort of brown, and very dark gray. Because dogs have no fovea, or an area with 100% cones, it is estimated their eyes for detail is 6 times poorer than that of a human. On the other hand, because they have so many rods than humans, so many more rods than humans, dogs can see in light 5 times dimmer than humans can. Rods are the vision receptors that detect dark and light. Well, let's also talk now about what dogs hear when we talk to them. Well, I'm fairly certain I'm not the only person who has one-sided conversations with their dog. Dogs are, after all, very good listeners, even though they haven't the foggiest idea what we're saying most of the time. However, dogs do have the ability to understand our tone of voice and listen to intonation cues in our words to get a general idea of what we're trying to get across to them. When talking to your dog during training sessions, your tone and intonation make a difference in getting his attention and help him understand what you want. Tone of voice reflects the attitude or emotional mood of the person speaking. Intonation is the fluctuation in our words. It can be a little confusing to tell the difference, but there are two different parts of language. When we speak, our tone tells someone how we are feeling, sad, happy, angry, tired, etc. Intonation, when we express our words with the upward or downward movement of sound. An upward intonation is how the voice rises at the end of a sentence. Way to go! Are you hungry? Well, a downward intonation is how the voice goes down at the end of the sentence. What's the matter? I would love to go, but I have to work. When making a positive statement, the intonation cue is usually higher to signal that the intent of the sentence means you're happy, excited, or pleased. The intonation cues in a negative statement take a lower pitch and reflect sadness, disappointment, or bad news. Understanding the difference between the two is important when giving commands to your dog because he can tell the difference and it can impact his understanding of what you expect from him. Well, a 2014 study done at the University of Sussex in England found that, like us, canines process verbal and nonverbal parts of speech in a different hemispheres of the brain. Elements of language are processed in the left hemisphere and emotional connotation is processed in the right hemisphere. Researchers point out that the study doesn't prove dogs have a complete understanding of all the emotional parts of speech, but they do pay attention to what we say and can hear the meaning of human speech and the emotion within it. How we say a command provides canines with a better understanding of what we're trying to convey. Research done by Dr. Patricia McConnell suggests repeated short sentences work better to increase motor activity to speed up a dog, while long held out continuous ones command a slower, more soothing result to calm him down. If your dog doesn't seem to understand what a command means, it could be he's confused because you aren't saying it in the right tone of voice or with the appropriate intonation cues. Simply like this, when you're training your dog, you give him his favorite treat right after he complies with the command, which helps him to learn and associate a word with the behavior you want. Intonation cues, along with your body language and tone of voice, give him more information and help him understand the intent of a command. Using a lower tone of voice with commands like sit, down, or stay can teach your pet to remain still until released. He understands what you mean by the downward intonation cues. It's also the voice you want to use when making corrections. A more excited tone of voice with upward intonation cues works better to get your dog's attention. Your excitement reflected in your voice will get him excited too. It's what you want to use when giving praise and teaching more active commands like come, fetch, roll over, heel. It tells your dog he needs to move in order to do what you asked. Well, there was a border collie named Chaser. Chaser could understand 1,000-plus words. Chaser's owner and trainer, John Pilley, discovered she was able to learn the names of her toys and other objects through successive discrimination. During each training session, she played with one object. As she played with a certain toy, it became valuable. Once an object assumed value, it was given a name, hidden, and then she was asked to go find it. It took many hours to train Chaser to learn the words, and it would be hard for most dog owners to replicate Pilly's success. However, canines can figure out the gist of what we want and gather a lot of information from the body language, tone of voice, rhythm of the voice, and intonation of speech. What your dogs hear when you talk to him is his favorite melody, your voice. How you use speech and tone of voice to convey what you want helps him to understand. He may not hang on your every word, but he does listen. You know, I hope y'all find that stuff kind of interesting. Sometimes it helps to think about what your dog actually sees and how he thinks and how he perceives his world. It's different than most people do think, but it certainly works well for them. Well, that's all I got tonight, folks. So see you next time in the Wolf Tejas Den.
And we'll be right back after these short words with Texas Wolf Dog Project.
Hello, this is Natasha Woodall, Vice President of Texas Wolf Dog Project in Chester. We are an all-volunteer and donation-based 501c3 rescue and adoption facility dedicated to saving as many adoptable wolf dogs and northern breed dogs in the state of Texas as well as surrounding areas. This is based off of available foster homes, suitable adoptive homes, and, of course, financial resources for veterinary care. We support responsible ownership and public education, as well as promoting education for other rescue groups, shelters, and animal control facilities concerning proper wolf dog identification, evaluation, and care. For more information on adoption, events, volunteer work, and how to donate, please visit our website at www.texaswolfdogproject.org or email us at info@texaswolfdogproject.org or visit us on Facebook. Thank you.
Hey, y'all. This is Jerry Emmelman, and you're listening to Wolf Dog Radio. Enjoy the show.
I would like to extend a special thank you to Katie tonight for being on the show. And please join us on March 14th for the second segment of Katie Beaver's Training Your Wolf Dog with Katie live to answer your questions. Remember to send your questions to guest@wolfdogradio.com. As almost everyone realizes early on with their wolf dogs, they are a special breed of canine that require a softer hand at training and keeping. It is imperative that training start at a very early age to strengthen the bond between human and companion animal and to bring some hopeful order into the lives of our wolf dogs. Wolf dog intensity requires a commitment of time dedicated to the animal's training and enrichment, time well spent in socialization and human interactions. We appreciate you joining us tonight, and we hope you enjoyed the show. If you have any questions about the show, please email us at questions@wolfdogradio.com and come check out our website at www.wolfdogradio.com for more information. And as always, remember, life is short. Hug your babies. Good night and be blessed.